This is an oral history with Charlie Burkhead, September 2008, at Lewis Clark Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I'd like to start off with our standard first question. Tell me a little bit about where you're from and how you got interested in landscape architecture.
Oh, gosh. Okay. I'm from Ashboro, which is down below Greensboro in Randolph County. And I graduated from high school in 1951. And the reason I got interested in landscape was that we used to have in the high school, we'd have professional day, and the high school, I guess they had them all over the state, and people would come in from all over the state with different professions, and you would sort of list what you thought to go into the classes that you thought you might be interested in. And I had always been interested in architecture, but mainly because I used to work for my father. He ran a furniture store, and he got tired of me, you know, because I would not work. And I had two brothers, Jack and Archie, and they were better at that than me. I was just a high school student, and he would find me asleep up in the attic of his store, you know, on some moving blankets and so forth, and he'd get mad. So he got mad, so mad one day, he went out and found me a job with a local architect, because I was always interested in art and drawing and doing pencil drawings and sketching this and that and whatever. And in high school, I got out of a lot of homework and classwork, because I would do all the posters, murals for the walls, you know, while the class was going on. So that's why I'm a dumbass, really. I don't know anything about it. I just barely got through high school. But anyway, Daddy got mad, so he talked this architect, John Croft was his name. And there were a bunch of architects working there that are NC State graduates. And Hyatt Hammond and, what are their names? A guy named Ted Peterson and some other guy. But I really admired them and talked to them a lot. So they tried to steer me toward architecture. And I was doing sweeping floors and filing. Then they let me do some drawing by, you know, tracing details or putting the title blocks on all the drawings or whatever, sort of grunt work. But anyway, it was good training, and I really enjoyed it. And it was these guys that were graduated from NC State really tried to push me toward architecture, and John Croft wanted to push me that way as well. And then going back to the high school thing, Gil Thurlow came down from NC State, and he talked about landscape architecture. Well, that always stuck in the back of my mind. When I came time to get into school, I registered in architecture at NC State, and just had grades, I guess, good enough to get in. But everything was, if you didn't have college preparation classes, you were retarded. they had to take retarded math, retarded English, retarded history, everything. That means I went to summer school a lot. Mm-hmm. But and couldn't take any CREF courses, because I had to take these retarded stuff to get me up. But anyway, when I got to NC State, the first year, I started thinking more and more about, well, if I'm going to be an architect, I'll be inside about 100% of my time, maybe 90%. And I like to be outdoors. I like to do camping and hiking and doing all those things. So I said, well, I'm going to switch over to landscape. So I switched over, and Gil pushed me, and Henry Campeffner was there. And he encouraged me to do it too. And but this guy John Croft that I worked for got really ripped out. He got mad with me because I went into landscape, and he chewed me out, said, "You're going to waste your time. You're never going to get anywhere. You know, you're not going to make any money. And why are you fooling around with landscape? It's not worth. You can get anybody to do the landscape. You don't have to have a college degree to do that." So that made me mad. So I said, "I'm going to do it despite you." And so after I was working for Lewis for a while, after graduation, John Croft called Lewis's office and asked for me. And he was so put out that he didn't speak to me for a long, long time. But he was doing a bank down in Asheboro. And the bank people, the board, said they wanted me to do the landscape because they knew I was a landscape architect and they wanted a hometown boy to do it. So John Croft called me and said, "Would you be willing to work with me on it?" I said, "Sure." You know, so I went down there and he started backpedaling a lot. He said, "I know you can probably design a better building than I've got here, but you know, this is just what they want," and blah 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 went on, you know, sort of backpedaling, you know, and saying, "Now, I want you to," and so I helped him design the front of it, and for a fountain, and little places downtown for planting, little outdoor sitting areas and so forth around the bank, and he was really happy with it, and we got to be friends again, you know. So I never did any more work for him though, but I did work for Hyde Hammond after he moved out. And Hyatt's married a girl that was from Asheboro, and she and I, her name was Burge. So she and I were always sitting together, the same graduating class, you know, BR, you know, and so I really had a crush on her. Then Hyatt married her, and it really ripped me out. But anyway.
Well, let's go back to school. Let's go back to when you were undergraduate. What were some of the courses that you taught, that you were taught?
You know, normally when you start out, you have to take regular college courses. And then you had some design classes. But it was all very elementary type stuff. And most of it was lectures and just sort of talking about landscape. And then you'd have in the second semester, it was on the semesters, it was on the term system, 3 terms, I think it is. And so the second term, you started getting into, that's when I switched over to landscape. And you started giving little problems. And Lewis wasn't there at the time, but Thurlow was, and somebody else. I can't think of his name. Don Inson or Inman or something like that. A lot of it was just design mixed in with sculpture and painting and history and that sort of thing. Then the second year, he got more into landscape, and I joined a fraternity and started doing my old stuff of not studying, and ended up that I didn't get back in to my second year, really. It was the second year. I got through 2 years. I couldn't get back in third year. Henry Cap had to call me in and said, "Charlie, you're going to enjoy the Army." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I'm not going to let you back in." He said, "Your grades aren't good enough, and you aren't applying yourself." He said, "You can do it. I know you can, because I've seen some of the stuff you've done." And he said, "You're just not settled down." So he said, "You go in the Army, grow up, and come back, and I'll let you in. Back into your third year." So it was 5-year curriculum then, so I had 2 of them behind me, so I mean, I had 3 years to go. So Lewis had just come, and I came back in to, and I met him, and that really sparked the whole thing for me, because he's a young man, Englishman, and with a lot of charm and a lot of skill and a lot of knowledge that I wanted to drain from him. So I buckled down, and everything started to turn up then. And I had that 2 years in the Army made me grow up and appreciate what I was doing. So I went on in and made the best I could, except I'd have relapses when we'd have I had a big problem that was due, and I was not working on it and just sort of goofing off. And Lewis took away my Christmas vacation and made me stay up there for maybe 1 or 2 days of Christmas I got. But I had to stay there to finish it because he wasn't going to pass me. He was going to... So anyway, he pulled me out and made me work. So I got a great deal out of the sculptors and painters that were there. And I have a great bent that way, so doing a lot of sculpture and painting now. And enjoyed those classes as much as I did, you know, the landscape. And when Roy Gusso was there, he was a landscape architect. His training was landscape architecture, but he was there at the university as a sculptor, so he taught sculpture classes. And he and Thurlow were great friends, and he would come in to crit our problems. And he looked at it from a sculptural point of view. And so I picked up a lot from Roy. And it's like there were so many people there to draw from. And you'd stay up all night long just with bullshit type of bull sections. And everybody, and some of the professors would stay there, like Cecil Elliott and other people, and you talk about design, and it got to be really so captivating that, you know, you just fell into like a big pit, and that's where I stayed. And it was really, really interesting. And I got so much out of Lewis because he would come out with the what was called a model box. And you do things on a three-dimensional scale. You look into the box and place things as if you were walking in that area. Whereas before, we were just doing it two-dimensional. This way, it was three-dimensional. And it really opened your eyes a lot as to the distance and a curve, you know, how sharp it, or how lazy it can be. But when it's down on the ground, it looks real sharp. You know, very curvy. So if you try to curve it too much with pencil, it doesn't work out the way on the ground, and you have to redo your design.
You had a visiting crit during that time, Bob Royster, right?
I'm sorry?
You had a visiting crit during that time, Bob Royster?
Oh, yeah. Robert Royster, yeah, he was there. Sasaki came down, what was that guy's name? He came from Texas, and he left a scholarship that I took advantage of. And it's, what is his name? Arthur Berger. And there were just a great overturn of people coming in to the school, and Lewis was responsible for all that. And it was interesting. Because you got all these different point of views, and it sort of shaped where I wanted to go later, because I thought so much of Sasaki that you know, I wanted to you know, go to Harvard, and but thought maybe I wouldn't be able to get in, wouldn't be able to do it. But somehow, I think through, and I'm not really sure, but I think Lewis wrote a letter for me, and I think Thurlow did, And anyway, one of those, or both of them, were instrumental in me getting into Harvard. And because I don't, and then Sasaki had met me down here, and we got along fine, and he probably, maybe he saw something, I don't know, maybe he didn't. But anyway, for some unknown reason, I got into Harvard. And that was, I got out of NC State and worked for Lewis before I went into Harvard. And I got married and had a child. And then went on up to Harvard in 1960 and 62. I was through 62. So I don't know, jog my memory.
Whenever, what class were you in at NC State?
Let me see. It was 1952 to 53. Then I went to the Army for 2 years. Then came back to State in 1957 to 60.
Okay. During your, on the second time you were at State, is that when Lewis started doing his office?
No. Lewis, well, he might have been. Because he was doing it over at Mordecai, and I started working for him. We worked in the basement, and that was an adventure in itself, you know, because everything was moldy and damp. You had to draw fast and store it somewhere else so the mold wouldn't heat it up.
What kind of jobs were you working on?
Oh, they were banks and subdivisions and I think a few trailer parks, industrial buildings, hardly any residential work. It was all commercial. And then Lottie Bryan was working there at that time, and I'm sure there was somebody else, but I can't think who it was. But then Lewis sold that house and moved over to Rothgap, and he had a two-story house. It was a one-story living area, but it was two-story in that you went, the land dropped off in the back, and the basement was all open to the outside. And, you know, you could walk out the door, and you didn't have to feel like you were going out, in and out of basement. So then Warren Edwards started working there, and Lewis was had an architect working for him, and then Henry Hammond was working there, and we just started carrying on the same type of work, all in commercial. Then Lewis started getting big projects like communities that he could design, and we'd all pitch in on the design of it, and and we stayed there, a couple of years? And then, maybe it was three, I don't know. But anyway, Kit, Lewis's wife, wanted to move out. She, stayed there, and then in Rothgab, but then we moved to a place up over the old Varsity Theater across from the university, so Lewis could come back and forth to work. And Warren Edwards went to work for Dick Bell, and I was Lewis's only employee. And now wait, let me back up a minute, because after I graduated from Harvard, I went to Canada and stayed up there for about a year and a half, and somewhere around there, working for a big architectural engineering landscape company, and it was run, the major people in the were owners were a landscape architect, an architect, and I think the landscape architect started the whole thing, and Mac Hancock, and then he came to Harvard as a visiting professor, and that's how I got to know him, and then he when he left, or it was the last day he was there, I asked him if he would consider me giving me a job. And he's in Canada, in Toronto. And he said, well, when you graduate, get in touch with me, and we'll see, you know, where I am, what's going on, and I'll remember you, and we'll just go from there. So I wrote him a letter, and he wrote me back and said, well, come on up. So I told him I was going to back to North Carolina, and when I was in Harvard, I was, of course, married and with a child, and we moved back to Asheboro and stayed there for a while, and then I got the job in Canada. So we loaded up a little trailer and hitched up this old car and hauled ass to Toronto. And it was just too cold. I couldn't stand it. But we had a wide range of work, so doing a lot of parks. So I got into designing parks in Nova Scotia and in Toronto and other places, small areas around. And I can't remember the names of the towns now.
But you're getting a lot of experience real fast by being at the job in Canada.
Yeah, because there were a lot of people in that office that you could, again, draw from. There were sociologists working there, and they were from all different types of backgrounds and different universities. And so it was a real melting pot. And it, again, there was two guys that worked for the Toronto, it's called Project Planning Associates. They had two guys that were filing and sweeping floors and cleaning up. And they were, one was a sculptor and one was a painter. And so when I'd get, since I had all that kind of outlet from NC State, I took advantage of those guys being there. And I'd call each one of them in as I was doing a project, and I was get a sculptor's point of view and then a painter's point of view, you know, of what my design was like. And I just used them. And because I liked these guys and they did work good, I went into the Mac Hancock's office one day and said, now before I'm going to get ready to leave, you know. And I said, go back to North Carolina. And I said, before I go, he said, you better take advantage and keep those guys there because they have a lot of good knowledge that you can glean. So
you got back to North Carolina and you've got your degree from State's done. Your Harvard's done, you've got work experience out in the field, and you go back and you start working for Lewis again.
Well, yeah, I had, I'd wanted to leave Canada, and I went down, it was an ASLA conference in Washington. So I went down, came down from Canada, and then Lewis, ran to Lewis there, and Richard Moore, yeah, was there, and I didn't know him, and he had just come in to State, and he was also, you know, I guess, you know, teaching in the landscape department, and he and Lewis were good friends, so I got to know him at that little conference in Washington, and Lewis told me he was opening up an office and going back into work, and he wanted to open up again and said, would you be interested in coming back and working for me? And I said, sure. So I went back to Canada. I said, I'll be back in touch with you. Went back to Canada, and I got this phone call from a guy who was in a class before me at State, Taft Bradshaw, and he was working for Strussall down in Florida. So he called me up and he said that he was leaving, but he wanted someone to take his place in Strussall's office, and he wanted to know if I was interested. And I said, well, I'm going from one climate to another, you know, and I don't know, I'm going to think about that. And he said, well, we can. It turned out that Lewis offered me $100 more.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why I ended up back here. And my wife is from was from North Carolina, and or she is. But we anyway, she's, of course, my ex-wife. But anyway, she wanted to come home, and she didn't. She wanted to come back to Raleigh because her part of her family lived in Raleigh.
Sure.
And I live close in Asheboro. So I said, sure. And Lewis wanted to start this office up. So we came back down here and rented a little garage apartment. And about two blocks from Lewis's office on Hillsborough Street. And then we moved into there. And it was an architect, Raymond Sawyer, working across the hallway. So we did some work for him. And he'd get us to do little things here and there, you know. And but it got to be cramped. It was two rooms. One big room where all the drafting things were. Then Lewis had an office conference type room, I think it was. I might be wrong on that. But anyway.
You said it was getting crowded. Were there more employees then?
Well, it was just not enough room to have two desks or three desks in there, you know. And but we did the best we could, and Henry Hammond was working there, and myself, and Lewis was teaching over at the university. Then he would come back and crit drawings, and we just got to the point where we were working late at night, you know, and Kit wanted to. Excuse me, wanted to move out. And Dean Cloyd's old house, about two blocks from the office over the theater. And so we walked up there, and that house was for sale. And we, Kit was in real estate then. So she worked some kind of deal or whatever, and she got that. And then we spent a lot of time renovating that house to make it usable. It's a two-story old Raleigh-type wood frame house. And we turned it into an office and worked there. And Lewis could walk out the school. It was closer, actually, for him than over the theater, because school design wasn't, you know, right in the middle of the campus, really. And he just had to walk across campus. In both places, and it turned out pretty well. And then we started getting a lot more things like Palmetto Dunes and big projects like big hospitals that were more of a complex type thing, different placement of buildings, you know. And then golf courses and subdivisions. And there were just a great deal of turnover.
Were there shopping centers going on then?
Yes, they were. Yeah, we were doing something, a couple things for the Rouse family up in Baltimore. And we did one in Texas, one in a place called Cross Keys up in Baltimore. And
Charlottetown,
yeah. That's, of course, in Charlotte. So, but the Rouse family, there were two brothers, James Rouse, and I can't think of his other his
Bill.
Brother.
Bill.
Bill. And then his sister, Dia. Dia?
Mm-hmm.
Paco. Yeah, and she was always mesmerized by Lewis. And of course, she got all the work for us we could, and we'd fly up there and take our drawings and our models and everything, you know, and then stay up there and work. Then we started working for another group out of Norfolk. I think, and what was their name?
Was
two brothers. Anyway, we did a lot of things for them as well. And I can't remember their names now. But anyway, they were big developers, and so we started spreading out. And then we started using people like Oren. What's that guy's name on the coast? He's
Pilkey.
Pilkey. Yeah, Oren Pilkey. Yeah, and he's still active down at the beach now, and has a lot to say about ocean development. You know, so we were doing Palmetto Dunes, and we picked his brain a lot, and we would call over people like Duncan Stewart from NC State to do the mathematics and help us with all of the drawings. You know, he'd do some perspectives for us. There was another guy that came to work for there, and he was an architect, and he did a lot of drawings. I don't know if he was a landscape architect or not. Wayne something. I'll think of that in a minute. But anyway, he worked there. I'm going to write it down too. Anyway, he, Lewis will remember him.
So you're working on Palmetto Dunes. This is no small project.
No, it wasn't a small project. It was a huge thing. And we'd get fly down there. Jerry Rooney would fly us down, and we'd do on-ground studies. And that's about the time I left Lewis, too. I should have stayed, but I got itchy feet and wanted to branch out on my own. But anyway, that was a big project. And Lamar was working there, and Henry, and Basil, and Roy Pender, and
Sally was there too.
Sally Showman, yeah. She was there. And Warren Edwards. Then he went to work for Bell. Anyway, it was quite a crowd. Seems like everybody, you know, would come through. And I sort of ran Lewis's office like a office manager. And they'd always ask Lewis for a job over in school, and he says, "I can't hire you, go ask Charlie." So they'd come over. If I didn't like them, I wouldn't hire them. And some of the, I'd say, couldn't draw, and, you know, and they just weren't, I think, bent toward landscape that much. Although I guess later they did become that way. Lewis hired just kept everybody going. I mean, he would take his fees and pump them back into salaries and into the school and things like that. You know, he could have stuck it in his pocket, but he didn't. He just kept pushing landscape architecture and getting bigger and bigger projects, and hiring more of the students to give them some experience, and to maybe ensure that they would go on to be landscape architects. But
what was different about what he was teaching?
What was different?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he brought a whole different aspect than anyone else at State had toward, is more of a modern movement. Thomas Church was here from California as one of the visiting professors, and he was like the father of modern landscape architecture. And all these, and Doug Bayless was here. They'll come back in a minute. But all these guys that would write about landscape architecture, and most of them had been as a visiting professor to State, and Lewis was instrumental in getting them there. And he remained friends with them, you know, throughout his life. And I think he still calls up several of them now.
So he was teaching what was the beginning of the modernist movement?
Yeah, because the people that had been to State, and what's that guy's name who did Tryon Palace? He was there. as a professor, and I can't think of it. But everything was symmetrical. You know, it was like French landscaping. Lewis brought in English landscaping, which was relaxed and more human, more usable, more of a bent on design, and that you could pick up. So I think mostly my forte is design. I mean, I can do the planting and everything else, but I think design was what I picked up from Lewis. And it was, you know, always sketching, and always drawing and doing overlays all the time to see if you couldn't do it a better way. And Thurlow and this other guy, what, I can't remember.
Willie Bumgarten?
Who?
Willie Bumgarten?
Yeah, he was there, but he was more in architecture, I think, wasn't
okay.
he? But anyway, there was some other guy that was when the landscape department was over close to Patterson Hall on NC State. He wasn't in his present location. The present location is the old cafeteria. And when they moved out of there, we moved out of that. The whole design moved from that building. They had Quonset huts and things from the war. And design classes were mostly in that building, but well, I lost my train of thought now. Anyway, I was
we're talking about Lewis's teaching.
Modern movement, really, and the library had a Mrs. Lyons, and she was really instrumental in sort of mothering everybody in the School of Design, no matter what it was. Then they also instituted a products design at the time, so there were three departments: architecture, landscape, and products design. And she, Mrs. Lyons, started bringing in all the books that these people would write, that being the librarian, and she would. But Royston and, for crying out loud.
Church?
Yeah. But there was another guy's name that was very, very...
Halpern?
Halpern. Yeah, Halpern. But then there's another guy, too, that came. Halpern came. And Lewis used to bring in an Englishman, a very proper Englishman.
Brian Hackett?
Yeah. Did you ever meet him?
Mm-mm.
But he was always straight-laced, you know, and wore the English three-piece suit all the time and had the little mustache and... you know, played the part. And every time an Englishman would come in, Lewis's English would come back to him, and it'd take months to get him back to where he was speaking American English. But anyway, the whole school started to turn around, because all the architects were people on Matsumoto. And again, I can't think of
Catalano.
Catalano and well, that whole group. You'll remember them more than I will. But anyway, they influenced Lewis, and Lewis influenced them, and it was give and take. And so that was a good thing about the school at that time, because you had so many people who were coming at design from a different point of view, and it helped you open your mind up and explore different avenues. Because Lewis always get those architects to come in and crit our plans. He would give us a design sketch or a problem, and then we'd work on it, and then we'd pin them all to the wall, and then the jury would come in and look at everything. It was great, a real eye opener, you know, because they would say, well, why didn't you do this or why didn't you do that? Damn, I didn't think of that, you know. So he began to think, well, okay, just don't stop with the first one. Although over in Lewis's office, we had to run the office as an office because we had to make money and to keep it going. And he would want overlay after overlay after overlay, and he wanted every scrap of paper had to be saved. And we had to show those to the client, say, well, we could have done this, we could have done this, we could have done this. And it got to be to the point that the client was confused. They came to you and wanted a solution. So I said, Lewis, we got to stop this, you know. I don't mind going through all the paper and so forth, and you can go through all the sketches and things like that, but the client doesn't have to go through it. You know, we need to settle on one design that we think is best and then get it through. Pour all our heart and soul into it and get it done and forget all these other things that it could have been. That worked out pretty well. We started hiring more people, you know, to come in from the school. And they brought over what Lewis established from Harvard. So when I went to Harvard, it was like going back to Lewis's class, because I already had all that stuff. And it didn't dawn on me that I should have gone somewhere else probably, because, you know, Lewis is going to bring it down from there, and then Sasaki's approach to it. And so all I got in up there was, you know, the same thing. So it got to be dull and boring after a while, you know, and I couldn't wait to get out. That was only 2 years, because it was just, already had it from Lewis.
So the school design at State was on par with Harvard Graduate School?
Oh, yeah, way, probably far ahead of them. But now they have a lot of different people there. I got really upset one time because Sasaki wouldn't come to class, or he'd be there for the crit, but not there doing the design phase you want him there. And he had monitors. He'd walk around, and I'd already had working for Lewis and working other places, been to State and all this stuff. So I didn't want to ask some of these guys who just graduated a year before me, you know, for their ideas, because I didn't respect them to start with. You know, I wanted Sasaki's ideas. But then I told Sasaki, I said, I came up here studying under you, not under Marvin Adelman. You know, he was a class monitor. I said, if I wanted him, I would have gone to Penn State with McCard, you know, if I knew that's what it was going to be like. And so we had a knockdown, drag-out battle about that, you know. But anyway, I guess it's just part of my mind wandering and thinking I should be somewhere else besides there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, back to the office again. Did you stay with the office when it moved to the Coger Center?
Moved to the coast?
Coger Center.
Oh, Coger Center. No, I didn't. Because when I left, they were still in the old house across from the school. And, you know, I don't think I'm trying to recall, did I ever go out to that Coger Center office? I don't think so.
Well, you broke out on your own.
Yeah.
What happened then?
I got tied up with a real loser, and he and I had knocked heads all the time, and I just got tired of it. And I said, you know, even though I was partner in this firm, you know, he was no designer. He was a politician. He just a horse's ass, and a landscape architect out of Georgia, and didn't teach him a thing. You know, I was head and shoulders above everything. And said, what the heck am I doing, you know, to partner with him? I'll go out on my own. So I left that and opened my own office. You know, if I'd be partners with somebody who's a know-nothing, you know, why? It wasn't stimulating. It wasn't, this guy was always interested in zoning and writing zoning ordinances and arguing in front of the city council. And that was a waste of time. You know, said that is politics. So that's all he wanted to be. And he did finally end up trying to run for office and got whipped handily. But because he was just, everybody saw that he just, you know, was not going anywhere. But anyway, I got out of that situation because we were having to, weren't getting anywhere anyway. It was hard times for landscape architects, and we had to have, we had one client when I was partnering this CPA thing, and he would pay us in vegetables. You know, he'd bring in, we were subdividing this land for him and helping him, you know, with the construction drawings and all kinds of stuff. And so he couldn't pay us, so he'd bring in bushel baskets of beans and tomatoes and hog meat and whatever, you know, and we divided up. It was just...
Why was it hard for landscape architects?
Well, it was, I don't know, people just weren't using landscape architects. Dick Bell and Jim Godwin had about the only other office in town, and Lewis was over at the school, and Dick Bell and Godwin didn't particularly cotton up to Lewis working in landscape and taking sort of work from them, I suppose. But Lewis was giving all the money back to the students and put it in scholarships and things like that, and not, you know, really interested in building a big office. But he was doing some really mind-boggling things around the state that opened everybody's eyes. And I think that really made Dick Bell and Godwin mad. Hope you don't print any of this. I don't have much respect for Dick Bell. He's just a loser.
But well, it was a hard time for landscape architects, and you were taking payment in vegetables.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just, and then we started getting other projects. Actually, it was a spinoff from one of the projects that, you know, I told you I couldn't remember the brothers' names up in Norfolk. Well, I'd go up there, and Lewis would go up once in a while, not often. But then these brothers got to the point, they'd call me, and through them, I got a couple of jobs after I left Lewis. And they tracked me down, and then there was another guy in Norfolk that was a friend of theirs that they introduced me to, and Stan Friedman, and he started doing some buying land in Garner and Cary and places around Raleigh, and I would do work for him. And then he got killed in a plane crash, so that sort of did away with that end of the business. But there were hard times because it was just too much. It was overbuilt, and I think we're going into an economic decline, and people weren't using landscape architects.
Was that in the 70s then?
Yeah, and they weren't using architects. They were using engineers. And the engineers had a great resentment from us because we were doing things that they should be doing. But they didn't have design ability. They just, you know, just did the engineering thing, and that was it. No imagination to it whatsoever. We just gradually began to turn around. And I think Lewis turned it around by working for the Rouse Company and then working for that Palmetto Dunes. And that led to other things, you know, because people were getting back, money was getting more available. And then Lewis's office was growing, and I think he was getting out of school, at during that time somewhere, but I wasn't working there. I should have stayed on with him, but I didn't. But I don't always do what I'm supposed to do, or what I should do.
Well, let's talk about some of your projects. What's an outstanding project of yours?
Well, I did a renovation for Blenheim Place, which is a housing project over in on Ridge Road. And a lot of the projects that I did, some of them were in Lewis's office, but he said go ahead and take credit for them, you know, like Sand Hills Community College, working with Tommy Hayes and his office. And then there were I started doing a lot of residential work, and I'd always told Lewis that was a, I thought it was a good adjunct to an office to go out and do sketch plans for people, and you know, help income wise. So we did a lot, you know, of that, and like consultation, and it was just their the big projects would be mainly big houses, and I started doing all the work over at Governor's Club, and I was doing some work not any of them are tremendously big work, you know, just almost like bits and pieces.
Well, some of those bits and pieces are important.
Well, they are, but you know, like you'd have a golf course that you want to redesign, or you have a trailer park. It seemed like work would come in cycles. Like at one time there was all apartment work, then that would change to subdivisions, then that would change to trailer parks, then that would change to residential work, and then start back with the office buildings, and then the apartment buildings. And I could go round and round in a big circle, and why that happened, I don't know. But just when it was like a flood, when the door would open, they would come in, and I got a lot of continuation of work that I started with that company that I was a partner in, and that would branch off into other things, you know, working with different architects doing, it turned out, just a lot of planting plans for a guy named Tom Shoemate, who was dead now, and then Bass, Nixon, Kennedy, our engineers, did some work with them. And
you designed a garden for blind people, right?
It's more a garden for people with dementia. It was over at the Forest of Duke. It's a what do they call them? Continuing living. That's not the name either. But anyway, you move. They would have individual houses. Then they'd have suites in a building, and then they would have a hospital, and then you're dead. You know, so. I did these gardens, several of them, for people with Alzheimer's, and that was really interesting. I did a lot of work for Peenick Home in the Southern Pines. Go down and just redesign existing things, like almost doing like sketch problems. You go down and they say, well, we got this area, what do you think we ought to do with it? And everybody's always working on a budget and didn't want to pay fees, you know. They said, but we want you to work on it, help us, you know, do this. So you're sketching something out. They said, well, we can take that and have our builder build it, and you can come back down and check it out and see if it's what you want. So it turned out to be a lot of that stuff. And There were two or three of those Alzheimer's gardens.
What's different about Alzheimer's garden? What element in there makes it different from just a regular garden?
That was funny because I didn't know anything about it. It really put me on the spot because a friend of mine was the director of some department over at the Forest of Duke, and she called me. She was an artist friend here in Raleigh, Leslie Jarema, and she called me and said, "We got this new building, and we got this big space, and we need a garden or some place to get people outside." And so I said, "Okay, babe, I'll try it." So I went over there, and they showed me the space, and it was like architects do. They have all these leftover spaces they don't want to do with, so that it was like you open the door and you walk out and just a little piece of grass and a big hill, and then the rest of the building was up, you know, stair-stepped its way up the hill. And I said, how can you turn this into a garden, especially for people that are, won't be able to climb that mountain? And so we had to do a lot of excavating and a lot of retaining walls and a lot of things to get it down to a level where we could use it. But before I could do that, I had to find out what the heck goes on in the minds of people with dementia. And so I went over to Duke, and I found this woman that and I can't remember her name either, but she was helpful, telling me what, I told her what I wanted to do. And she helped me by telling me what these people do and what makes them do that. You know, it's part of their brain that's non-functioning. And they said they are skittish, they're always looking down, and a shadow pattern will throw them, you know, and or a changing pattern, and they're always walking in circles, and they'll stand open to closed doors. And repetitive things, and but they like to put their hands in water, they like to feel grass, you know. And she just went into a lot of, gave me a little lecture, through three of them really, because I'd go back over with my drawings and she'd go through it with me and say, "This is good, but I don't think that is." They might get trapped in there, so they everything in the design has to lead you around to a place you were before. There are no corners, no place you get, you know, stymied. You're always left out. And I picked up on the opening and closing of doors. I put an arbor in and put a door handle, door knob on both sides so that they could stand there and open and close the gate and then go through, then turn around and open it again, but they're still in the garden. But it was an arbor vines over the top. And then the paving pattern had to be simple, because any change of pattern, if it were angular, like when I was working with Lewis, we'd do these shopping malls, and the paving pattern was a big deal, because you change pattern, you're in a different section of the shopping center, or you take a big color of brick or whatever, paving pattern, it lead off to, say, Sears or someplace like that. And then we put in a lot of circular things with gardens in them and so forth. So, but in these gardens for demented people, you can't have that, because the pattern changes, and if it's angular, they stop and they don't know where to go, and they get all nervous and they can't. And they're older people, and they're hard to get in and out of benches and swings and things. But they love to swing. And so I put a lot of swings in, and I put benches in that were not like we designed at Lewis's, but they were more form-fitting, and they could use their legs and their hands to get up, push themselves out. and a lot of them were, you know, form-fitting. And it was just interesting because you had to take in the fact that you were dealing with people who were really vital people when they were young and smart, and they were very highly intelligent people, the ones that I was. I'd walk around and read over in the Forest of Duke. The garden opened off of a big dining room and a day room, and their rooms, the patients' rooms were right off these areas, and the staff would take a picture of these people when they were young, and then write up their history. It was amazing what these people went through, and their backgrounds are just astonishing. But then here they are, not even recognizing anyone, not remembering what they had done before, just like a vegetable. And it just brought tears to your eyes. You sit there, and you want to. I get choked up thinking about it, but. Well, how can you help these people? So that became part of the garden. I put a big fountain in so that they could sit on the edges of it, but not too deep. They put their hands in it, and then if they fell in, you know, they could get up and get out. And then the swings the same way, and different plants. Like Lewis taught, sensual things, like feeling the plants, smelling the plants, seeing the plant, tasting it, you know, because you don't know when they're going to. No thorns, no poisonous plants.
Quite a bit more than you would think.
Yeah, it just led, you know, that's what was so fascinating about it. Because it got to be, and I built this big model of the whole thing because I wanted to sell it to all these doctors and the board, the board. So I made this big model. And got that from Lewis, you know, put it up on the table and let them look through and see where they were going, you know, or look down on, or take part of it out and tell them how I was going to build into that big, you know, make a contour map in the model, and then take some of it away and replace that and show them how it would be built so that they would do it. Not just say, okay, this is pie in the sky. We don't have the money to do it. Get them as enthusiastic as I thought I was, you know.
Right.
But all of it came from Lewis. I mean, the model, the three-dimensional thing, the using different things in landscape, and the sensual things, because he had us do a sensual garden, you know, as a sketch plan one time, which was interesting. And, I mean, you know, takes you off, makes you think, makes you do something.
Well, the question I was going to ask next was how did the teachings of Lewis affect your own practice? But I think you've explained that pretty well.
Well, it was just in different ways. You know, what you pick up, you store in your mind, or you make a sketch, or you do something. Or you mentioned earlier when we first came in about the diaries, Lewis keeping all his diaries. I kept diaries too, and I'd write down some of the things that, you know, I hear from Lewis and go back periodically and read them, which I found out later was a non-productive thing because I didn't feel like I was getting anywhere. You know? I was doing the same thing 4 years ago, you know, still writing about it. But you know, one thing leads to another, and it just touches off little avenues that you want to go through. And the whole sketching thing, Lewis, and all the artists over at NC State, the sculptors and the painters, Manuel Bromberg and Duncan Stewart and Ray Musselwhite and
Joe Cox.
I mean, just tons of them. And you know, you get around people like that, and unless you're a dumbass, you got to pick up something, and you start sort of want to mimic their life, you know. I never felt like I wanted to be a teacher, though. But I would take Lewis's classes for him sometimes, you know. I never wanted to really do that. I wanted to just do the design.
What do you think made the associates' designs different from other landscape architects?
I'm sorry, say that again.
What do you think made the associates, Lewis Clark Associates designs, what made them different from other landscape architects?
I don't know, because I didn't pay much attention to what they were doing, other people. I had too much in front of me to really worry about other things. But then once in a while you run across something, I'd run across something that one of them had done, and I'd say, my God, you know, a landscape architect did that. I mean, why? I mean, it was like, you know, that old parterre garden, or you flip one side and it's the same as the other side, you know. What do you call that? Anyway, it's just non-imaginative landscape architecture. And I think Lewis introduced a modern way of doing things, and you never... I had one architect tell me one time he got tired of working for Dick Bell, because he said the only thing I had to have was the same curve, what do you call them, drawing curve, and so I just have call up Dick Bell and say what number curves you used, and I'd pull it out and I'd draw it, you know, and then I have to use him, you know. He said, but Lewis, you know, didn't seem to do that. You know, we did a lot of curvy things and a lot of things, but some of it, you know, would have right angles and whatever the design called for. You know, not all of them were the same, and you couldn't, it was kind of hard to say that this is a Lewis Clark garden, you know, because it was kind of like the West Coast movement came to North Carolina, came to the East Coast. And they used to say that at that time, Halperin would come over, and all the other West Coast people would say, and Tommy Church, he'd say, well, if we had a Sunrise magazine instead of a Sunset magazine, because they had everything in Sunset magazine, all their work was published there. So we'd all rip them out of magazines and go down and get them and rip them out and keep them in our files. But we didn't have anything over here like that until Lewis started it. And then it, you know, it spread out to Florida and Fred Strussel and other people. Oh, that's another guy who used to work for Lewis, young Fred Strussel. And then Lamar and Strussel became real good friends. And I don't know where Lamar went down to work for him or not, but Taft Bradshaw did. He worked for... Fred Sr. So you're going to have to direct me on things I've talked about, because I go off too many avenues.
No, you've done fine. You've actually answered all my questions just about. What's the one important thing to know about Lewis Clark?
Sense of humor. He's got a sense of humor, that's for sure. And he's... his openness, his open heart. You know, he has, like I said, he was not interested in making money for himself. He's interested in paying us so we would, you know, work with him or would stay there or whatever. So that's, a lot of times we'd go without pay, you know, just because it was working for Lewis. And his magnetism is, his approach to things, you know, his way of explaining things, you know, and that English charm. It just mesmerized people. You know, then here we come in, and a lot of us were Southerners, we'd come in, and it's, we don't want to talk to you, we want to talk to Lewis.
Well, it is well to remember that there weren't that many foreign people in North Carolina at that time.
Yeah. Well, there were people in Greensboro and High Point and other places around, but their designs weren't, I mean, they were functioning offices. I mean, they were making money and they were doing a lot of things, but they seemed to be, you know, a pattern. Dick Bell, for instance, maybe I shouldn't say all of this about him, but, you know, I just got to the point, you know, well, what is he doing? Everything is the same. He started writing, doing these state parks. And he, it was all, the first half of it was all the same. You take the two different parks, the pamphlets, and you open page to page. And they were always the same. Same criteria, the same diagrams, the same this, the same that. the plan might be a little different, but it was similar to the other one. And it was always this large scale stuff, so you were, you know, just like drawing things out on a map. And I've done a lot of parks, but not any state parks. And at that scale, that group I worked for in Canada did a lot of state parks. But they would get involved in the intricate design, and that's what helped, because, you know, it's a thing where thousands of people use it, like, you know, like the mall downtown Federal Street when Lewis was doing that. It was you know, just had to accommodate a lot of people, and then they were abusing things, and of course, you know, the way it goes is the public gets a hold of it, they tear it up. But I just think that what you remember from Lewis is it's not the same thing all the time. You know, it's not that he goes out of his way to be different, he just is. You know, and he has well, a good point of view. And I guess that was one of the reasons I wanted to go to Harvard, because he had been there, you know. Not that I was going to pattern my life after him, but it all seemed to, you know, fall into place.
What do you think about landscape architecture today?
It's really pretty exciting. You see a lot of people who like to call themselves landscape architects, and they even have TV programs about people that, what is it, channel? Anyway, they have people who come in and do garden design. Since I do a lot of garden design, I'm interested in that. But there's a distinction when you see a garden that's done by a landscape designer and then a landscape architect. The landscape designer just doesn't seem to know how to put it together. And like a big mishmash of everything, like interior decorators, some of them, you know, they would put, at one time, they put everything into a room that they could possibly think of. No continuity, no simplicity, no flow. It's just things in a room, and they call themselves interior designers. Well, some of these garden designers are exactly the same way, but you see landscape architects using the outside as an extenuation of the house or an outside room, and these people are like, okay, I sit there and look at these programs, and you just almost get physically sick thinking people spend that money, you know, to do that stuff, and then call themselves, you know, landscapers. And it gives us, I think, a bad name. But that's being elitist, probably. But I can't help but be that way, because it's just, you have to choke up a lot of times, you know, take back the fact I went to Harvard, because people think that's a supposed to be make me better than everybody else, and it doesn't. You know, it's just that another something I can put behind my name, I guess. But sometimes I wish I hadn't gone.
Do you wish that you had done something besides landscape architecture?
No, I just wish I'd gotten out after I got my degree from NC State. I didn't have to compound the error by going, not the error, compounding it by going to Harvard and going. I should have maybe gone to Penn State, where McCarrigan was, you know, and get a different point of view. But I didn't, so no point in going back at it. But I think, you know, when you ask me what the state of it is, I think the state of it is pretty healthy. It's people are, but they're using more garden designers than landscape architects. And although we're putting out, I imagine, a lot of people. When I graduated from NC State, there were three of us in the class, three graduating. And when we were over in Reynolds Coliseum at graduation day, they called out the landscape architects, and then three of us stood up, and everybody started laughing. I said, what is it? Is it? I said, uh-oh, we're in trouble. Jerry Turner was one, and Lindsey Cox was the other. I looked at them and, you know, we're in for it. You know, we don't have enough people out here, not enough people going to school to be that, you know. But I think it's picking up. But there are a lot of people that think it's easy. It's an easy profession. I find it somewhat easy because I like to do it and I'm trained in it. But some of these people are garden designers, get into it, and they just think, okay, here's a way to make money. And they see the pamphlets, the magazines, and things that they can cop, and things they can do. And they don't come from a design background. They come in as a carpenter, so they can build a screen wall, and that's fine. But they might put it in the wrong place, you know, and not be a part of things. You'd say, you know, you see one design, and you say, well, you just, why don't you just put a door there and put four walls on it and walk out into this little square? You know, it doesn't do anything for us. The ground is all blocked off. You don't have sight. You know, Lewis, the teacher, said, in the model box, that if you have, you know, a house or a building, that everything out this landscape doesn't have to be the same. You know, you don't get the same view. You do something for you know, like if you're in the living room, you sit down and you get a long view. You get a dining room. That might be all in a row, and you get a dining room, and you want plants and fountains and things where you're sitting inside, or you could move outside and eat, you know, close to the kitchen and so forth. Or if it's a bedroom on the end, you get sort of a view away from the house with a little bit of planting in front. It draws you out into the landscape. So you're getting different views. You don't get that if you have parterre gardens, or the French thing, it's that long vista all the time, the long vista. But with the English landscape architecture, you get different views. And I think that's what, you know, Lewis Kapp put. He didn't pound it into it. He just, you know, just say, you know, why don't you try this or try that, you know. And so you just pick up and you just start doing it second nature.
What's the one thing to know about Charlie Burkhead?
Don't believe anything he says.
Oh, I don't believe that.
No, it's yeah, it's you know, as old saying, don't do as I do as I say, you know. But it doesn't always work out, so you have to not worry about not making any money. Because that was true. What they said when you first came into the School of Design, they have these big and they'd say, look at the guy next to you, and said, he won't be here next year. And the only way you can make money at architecture or design is marry it or inherit it, because you're not going to make it on your own. You know? But of course, a lot of people have made money at it. But you just don't. You can't go look at that. You just have to look at what you're going to, your integrity, and what you're going to do for the client. Because that's what you're in business for, to help somebody. So, or else they wouldn't call you. And I picked up a lot of work just by consultation, because you know you go out to people who can't afford or don't want to think that they can afford a landscape architect, and maybe in some cases they can't, but it's according to who they pick. But if you go out and you do a consultation, you can't move the street, you can't move the house, you can't move the big oak trees, and you can't make the backyard any bigger or much smaller, so you have to do something, you know, quickly. And you give them a direction, and they say, we can work on this for year to year to year to year. And then you go by the hour, you know, and you make a few $100 and pays the bills, and you go on. And if you get enough of that, you can pay the rent too, you know. But it's, I think landscape architecture has a lot more avenues of that are open to it, because you're working with different clients, you're working with different buildings. The problem with architecture, unless you're just a complete modernist, and there are some that aren't, you see buildings popping up all over town. Well, why? Why did they do that? This one, you've seen one over in Cameron Village next to the Harris Teeter. It looks like a fruitcake or a wedding cake or something or other. It must have been a fruitcake who designed it. I mean, it's just, you know, why? What are they doing? But you see a good landscape. I mean, you've got to accommodate cars and people moving around. You've got weather. You've got all kinds of things you have to deal with. A building, you just put up four walls and air condition it or heat it, and you put a little office here and a little workroom there and a toilet here and a whatever, and fit it all together in a square or a rectangle or whatever. But that's not what you do with landscape, because no two pieces of property are exactly the same. And you only have your brain and your hands to do what your brain tells you to do, and you see different things that you want to do. Some of them don't turn out, but some of them do. And it's always a happy thing when it does. Like those Alzheimer's gardens, it was always interesting to go over there later on and just sit off in a corner someplace and watch the people as they went around. And I tell you, it'd make you cry. And I just love it. It's more of a challenge than engineering, architecture, because you got it. You know, everything you have in the outside is hard to relate to as far as scale. Inside, you know, you get stairs that are always, you know, the riser is 6 inches, the tread is 12. Rooms are such and such a room, you know, size. And it becomes the same thing. And you're not dealing with it. You get outside, though, and a tread, a riser becomes anything from 3 inches to 7 inches. It can become a foot to a foot and a half or whatever. It's just how you want to do it. And you can curve it easily. You know, you can just working with the land, and you're molding land, and it's like sculpture. You know, and you use the plants like you're painting something, because you want a red something over here, so you've got a red plant. It might not be all year round, but in a particular time it does. You know, and you can have something blooming in a garden all the time, and but you can't go into a room and have it have the furniture changing all the time. You can, you know, from season to season, it's always the same thing. But you go outside and it's completely different.
What's the one important thing then to know about landscape architecture today?
Today, trying to live without the car. You know, the gasoline, the way it is, and everything is just turned up on its neck. Because of the car. I mean, we're so addicted to it, and we have to, instead of taking a plane or a train, you know, do you ride the train very much? It's fun. And you know, you watch the landscape go by. You know, I hate to fly. I just hate it. Not that I'm afraid of it, but it's just, you're in that little compartment and little enclosed space, and you can't get up and walk around until the pilot tells you you can. But on a train or a car, you know, you can get out and walk around. But everybody has, they have to have three or four cars. You can't get by with just one. You can't do it. You don't walk anywhere anymore. You know, and I think it's going back to it. I think we're finding we have to, the landscape's becoming more important because these little shopping centers are made now into town centers. You know, different types of buildings, and you walk around a corner, you might see a car, you might not, you know. No more of the enclosed malls, they're all outside, like Cameron Village was at one time.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about the change in the shopping center designs being reflective of the cars.
Well, you see them all over. They're all around Raleigh. Streets of Five Points or whatever it's called. And then there's Briar Cliff or Briar Park or whatever. But it's made... It's still the problem of the car. And North Hills has changed so that... you know, almost all the cars are down or in a car parking garage. There are a few around in places, and it makes it interesting in a way, but it's not like the interior mall where you're not going to look to see if you're going to be run over. If you're outside, you have to watch when you go off the street. So I guess it does make it like a little town, you know, and but there's certain things that they miss out on, and it's all around the holy dollar, you know. They got to make money out of it, and so they always offer you little boutiques and unique restaurants and great shopping areas, and it's the same spiel. And that's for every shopping center now. Instead of a human place to go shop or some other kind of description, it's the cute little boutique, the little outdoor cafe or whatever, and some of them don't even have enough space for three tables outside, you know, to make it interesting. So it's just, I don't know, it's changing, but I'm not so sure it's all for the good.
But as a landscape architect, you think that should be considered?
Oh yeah, I think a landscape architect is who they should call to start with, but they end up calling their architect. Because over going back to the Forest of Duke, they had an add-on to the building that I was working with. And so they called me back to do two more little gardens there. And the inside of the mall was made to look like a street. And they had outdoor light fixtures, fountains, even a stoplight, but no cars. And they had door, you walk in someone's room there, you know, you go down next time, a few steps down, there's another door, or a big window, and that's a beauty parlor. And then across the way is a little cafe. You know, they made it, the architects did a good job of that. I don't know what the outside, I did my little gardens and I think did a terrific job. But anyway, it all turned out okay. But then they don't do anything with the rest of the land. And they didn't plan as far as... the Forest of Duke was the same... Forest of Duke and... Peony Comb down in Sanford, Southern Pines. They
what was the name of that one again?
Peenick, P E N N I C K, or P E N I C K, I guess one N. But they designed it for sustained living, I think they call it. And you sell your home, and you go there, and you either buy a little cabin, you know, or you then you live in that, then you move into the building, the main building, which is like maybe an apartment, big as this room, maybe a little bit bigger. And then from there into a hospital room. hospital bed, and then there for the graveyard. They ought to, if they're going to do that, they ought to think of making it, taking it a little further. You know, the outside people, they aren't encouraging people to move around a lot. I did something by accident down there. They had this big courtyard that was off a dining room and a recreational room, as they called it, and like a little three-sided area and then parking on one side. You know, it was just overgrown and a tangled mess. So I said, we got to get rid of everything. So we went in there and we tore out everything. And boy, you would think that I had a ponytail at the time. They said, that little old man with a ponytail has come out here, you know, and he's tearing up this stuff. And everybody got mad as hell, and they were going to get me, you know. But it got their blood stirring and got their energy going, and it really turned out to be a good thing for them. But we put back a good garden for them, and they were happy after that. But they didn't want to see things changed. And people that... Who was that?
It's Nigel.
Who?
Nigel.
Oh, Nigel.
Hello.
Where are you?
Hey,
man.
We're recording.
You want to turn it off then?
Oh, no, well, you keep going. I just came to pull a file. I gotta make a copy.
Okay.
Hey, you want to teach some more this semester?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll give you a call. They loved you last semester.
I'll talk to you if you're going to hang around. Let's finish this, then I'll see you.
Okay.
Well, that's really all the questions I have for today, Charlie.
Really?
Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
No. Is that enough time?
Yeah.
Too much, right?
No, it's perfect. It's perfect.
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of things that, you know, for the school and what they're doing now, I don't know that it's a natural progression. I think that a lot of the things that the old crew that was there from architecture to landscape has changed, and it's not coming out the same as it used to. And I don't know whether it'll ever change. I think it's really, you know, it's just like putting people out that are engineers. But at one time it was a very invigorating place to be, because NC State was one of the, if not the leader, one of the leaders of landscape architecture in the country. And a lot of people have moved out into bigger, better ways of life, you know, and big offices, and doing well. So I think that it's probably as healthy as it would have been, considering everything that's going on. I mean, getting into wars and everything else, you know, that maybe we gave able to landscape some of those places. When I was working in Canada, that firm was doing a Kuwait waterfront and a whole new town, and I never got to work on it because I was not, had been there long, and I didn't stay long enough. But it is a way that it should go. And the firm, I think, it was founded with landscape architecture, and then the other things were brought in: architecture, engineering, sociology, psychology, all that was brought into it. But it started around landscape. So that's why I wanted to go up there and see how it worked out and what it was like. And it was, I think, rewarding. I only stayed there. If it hadn't been so damn cold, I'd probably stay up there for a long time.
Can you think of anybody today, any landscape architect firm today that's the center of in other words, they're the controlling factor like it used to be?
No. I don't see them anymore. They're not like the Ekbos and the Halperins and the Clarks and of course, I'm leaving a whole bunch of them out, but they're just not around. They've gotten older. They're passing on to their sons, and like Strussall, no longer. I think he might be dead, senior, and young Strussall is running it, and he used to work for Lewis, And I don't know what his office is like. I've never seen it. But I don't know that it's going to, I don't know if it's going to have a happy ending. You know, there was a great, maybe it's just because I'm getting older. I don't know. And I don't see it. With Nigel, I went over to Crit one of his classes, and I, you know, just like some of the architects would come down there, like Matsumoto would come in to Lewis's Crit, they walk around, look inside, I don't see anything worth critting, and walk right out. You know, you haven't done your job. You haven't exploded everything. You're not ready for a crit.
Is that what you do?
That's what I did over there. And I could destroy them.
Well, Charlie, I've
certainly
enjoyed talking to you today, and I'm glad that you spent the time with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And I will close it with that.
Well, this is going to be dedicated to Lewis, right?
Of course.
Right, okay.